then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 30th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
Okay, now, most of you folks listening out there by now will have had at least some contact with internet goat dancing. And when you ask these loons what exactly is the big beef with Harold Covington, on those rare occasions when you can get any kind of coherent answer at all, you'll hear, well, Harold is always attacking everybody in the movement. This week, I apparently did something that is even more horrible than my habit of attacking everybody. Instead of, quote-unquote, attacking somebody, I allegedly defended somebody. Although, just like my so-called attacks, not really. I'm talking about Bill White, of course, who was recently released from prison after serving 2.5 years for nothing. No, I mean it, for nothing. The courts themselves agree it was for nothing. A number of federal judges have confirmed that it was for nothing. The alleged criminal acts that he was charged with would never be criminal in any sane society to begin with. They were completely protected by the United States Constitution, and in fact, even a federal judge had to so rule, eventually. The Bill White legal case is immensely complex, and it's of great significance to both our own movement and to the future of free speech and freedom of thought in this country, for reasons I'll get into in a minute. But for now, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version. Suffice it to say that the Obama regime tried to imprison Bill White for the crime of posting things on the internet that the government did not like. Yes, really, that's all it was. They lost every time they tried to successfully prosecute and convict White, because he quite literally didn't do anything. He just said and wrote and published things that the Obama regime did not want him saying and writing and publishing. But since they couldn't charge him with that, then they basically made up a bunch of incredibly silly stuff that, like I said, even the federal courts ruled was silly. For example, the first charge on which White was arrested was of publishing the name and the address of the foreman of the jury in the Matt Hale case, which was at that time about a 6-year-old federal criminal case. This guy's name and address were matters of public record. White didn't publish anything that couldn't be found in 3 minutes by somebody who knows how to use Google, and yet he was arrested for publishing information that was a matter of public record. And it just went on and got even more ridiculous. He was in some kind of dispute with a real estate agency in Roanoke, Virginia. He owned a number of properties in Roanoke, and he allegedly wrote a rather stiff letter to one of the negress realtors there or something of that nature, and they claimed that he was threatening this woman, and she got up in a court of law and said, oh, I just felt so apprehensive when that racist motherfucker Bill White done wrote me that nasty letter. He be threatening my black ass. And what the prosecutor was trying to do was actually a lot more sinister than just putting away one man. What they're trying to do in this country, legally speaking, one of the items on their legal or judicial agenda is to establish a principle similar to what exists in Europe, whereby in the first place, all that is necessary for a threat to occur is for someone, the person allegedly being threatened, to claim that he or she feels apprehension or some such BS. In other words, you know, you could be just walking down the street whistling Dixie, and if some nigger or some Jew goes and runs and calls a cop and says that he or she feels threatened by your presence or threatened by the tune you're whistling or something like that, you could be arrested and sent to prison. That's one legal precedent they want to establish in this country. Also, the judicial system in this country wants to try and establish this European-style legal principle that the infliction of emotional anguish constitute some kind of assault or civil rights violations or harassment or something of the kind. But the thing is, anything can cause emotional anguish in somebody. I feel emotional anguish when I see a nigger in the Oval Office. So, of course, then once you establish that precedent, the law becomes a matter of whose emotional anguish is of sufficient importance to be punished by law. Anyway, the violation of Bill White's First Amendment rights was so blatant that even their own appeals court judges repeatedly ruled in White's favor. But the government just plain refused to release him. Not on bond, not after the courts had thrown out the charges and ordered him released. A court orders to free Bill White were simply ignored, and when they became too pressing, the FBI just slapped another charge on him and dragged him into court and had him denied bail yet again. Oh, I beg your pardon, that's not completely correct. On one occasion, Bill White was, in fact, released on a habeas corpus order on the grounds that there were no legal charges pending against him because the court had thrown them out, and therefore there was no conceivable legal reason for keeping him in prison. White was able to go home for something like 5 days before the government filed new charges against him and took him back to the torture cells in Chicago, needless to say, without bail, again. Now, all this time, the FBI and the federal attorneys and so forth were using what Stalin used to refer to as physical pressure, in other words, torture, in order to force White not just to plead guilty and let them off the hook and vindicate them, but to help them imprison other people on false charges. Like Randy Weaver and Susan McDougal and so many other people down through the years, Bill White's real crime in the eyes of the FBI and the government was to refuse to become an informer. The regime and its goons lost a total of 5 cases against Bill White, one after the other. They just kept forgetting little details like letting him out of jail when they lost, and a judge said he was innocent. Bill White spent 2.5 years in prison, despite winning every case and forcing the government finally to admit that he'd done nothing wrong. In April of this year, they finally kicked him out the door. I need hardly add, they did so without a word of apology and without 1 cent of compensation for 30 lost months that he will never get back again. Now, the significance of the Bill White case is that for the first time since World War I, a native-born American citizen has been arrested and charged and held in prison by the United States government purely on the basis of words written or spoken. Of course, the government does that to Muslims all the time, since the Jews who control American society hate Muslims. We're allowed to hate them, too. In fact, we're required to hate them. But Bill White is not a dark-skinned Muslim. He is a native-born white male who holds nationalist views and who was imprisoned for 2.5 years for those views, despite repeated rulings on the part of the courts that he was innocent and, in some cases, in outright defiance of court orders for his release. Now, I say again, all of this was for words, words only. For the first time, to my knowledge, and well, since I can remember, the federal prosecutors never even made the attempt to claim in court that Bill White was doing something violent or illegal. It was just because of the words that he posted to his website. And then later on, the words that he emailed to this real estate agency in Roanoke or whatever. A lot of people will say, well, Matt Hale was imprisoned just for words, and that's true as far as it goes. Matt Hale was actually imprisoned for the crime of typing a single sentence into an AOL instant message chat room, that sentence being, "I cannot have anything to do with this." But in Matt Hale's case, there was at least a kind of underlying act of violence. I know this was way before a lot of you people's time, but in 1999, this weirdo named Ben Smith, who apparently knew Matt Hale and was a follower of his little, you know, group, went berserk, and he, if memory serves, shot a Puerto Rican postman or a Puerto Rican of some kind, and he shot some nigger. And the nigger turned out to be an assistant basketball coach at Northwestern University. And so here we have a horrible, wicked white racist who has actually laid violent hands upon the great god of American assholes. Basketball, or should I say, basketball. And the state of Illinois just went berserk trying to get Hale for this. They actually hired an informer who spent about 2 years getting close to Hale just to try and entrap him into some kind of statement or other, which he eventually did in that chat room. They paid this guy like $50,000 for 2 years to, in essence, entrap Matt Hale. I don't remember where I got this impression, but it seems to me that I remember from the time that some of the people in Illinois, some of the authorities, police, maybe the judges, the politicians, for some reason had gotten the idea that Hale was actually responsible for Ben Smith going out and doing this shooting thing. In fact, Hale actually got a special episode of Law and Order produced about his case, where this was actually before he was arrested and sent to prison, wherein the liberal producers of Law and Order fantasized about arresting him and sending him to prison because he was allegedly responsible for some follower who shot a nigger, blah, 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 blah. So the Illinois authorities were obsessed with getting Matt Hale, and they did have this one underlying act of gunmanship or whatever on the part of Ben Smith back in 1999. But in Bill White's case, there was never any suggestion at all of any kind of violence or actual physical illegality, and the federal government didn't even bother to make any. That's what freaks me out. I'm serious. This is the first case I can remember where someone has been arrested and held in prison for all this time purely on the basis of words alone, without even a pretense on the part of the government that he actually did anything. So the Bill White case is significant for that reason as well. Now, White was also subjected to physical torture by the Federal Bureau of Investigation while he was in prison as part of repeated attempts to suborn perjury and coerce White into falsely accusing other people of crimes. Now, this physical abuse consisted of Stalin's typical bag of tricks from the gulag: bright lights, 24 hours a day in the solitary cell, sleep deprivation, refusal to allow a prisoner to bathe or clean himself or his clothes. They chain the prisoner to a chair or someplace and then refuse to let him go to the bathroom until he shits or pisses himself. And then they refuse to let him change clothes for 24 hours. And they make him sleep in his own excretions. They use sensory deprivation, extremes of cold and heat, sleep deprivation, like I mentioned. By the way they explain away sleep deprivation in the federal prison system is they put the prisoner on a suicide watch. And they claim that as part of this effort to make sure that the prisoner doesn't off himself, they have to come by his cell every 15 minutes and wake him up to make sure he's still alive and he hasn't managed to somehow, you know, choke himself on a pillow or something in his sleep. And so when you've got somebody coming around at 15-minute intervals and waking you up all night, and then they drag you out of bed at 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and they still won't let you sleep, and this goes on for 3 or 4 days, that is a form of torture. And yet they also do this number where the prisoner is awakened abruptly and he's dragged out of his cell at all hours for pointless so-called interrogations. And these interrogations consist of FBI agents and cops yelling and roaring at him and threatening him, threatening his family, constantly raising their hands as if to strike him, or maybe even striking him light blows on the back of the head that leave no marks because they're concealed under the hair, etc., etc. Now, the FBI and the federal authorities regularly use sexual fear and humiliation as well. They threaten white prisoners with being sodomized by niggers. They threaten women prisoners with being thrown into the men's section of the prison. Guards of the opposite sex are constantly conducting unnecessary body cavity searches, like you were at an airport. I mean, that kind of crap. Now, one thing you need to bear in mind about torture in U.S. prisons, which goes on all the time, is that from what I understand from those who have been through it, the feds at least usually keep to a fairly strict no-bruise rule. It's called the no-stretch-marks rule. They'll usually do nothing that will show up as an embarrassing bruise or mark during a court appearance or while somebody's being perp-walked to humiliate him, that kind of thing. Now, this means that in federal lockups, at least, they'll seldom actually beat a prisoner, which for some reason, seriously, some of these people believe that means they don't use torture if they don't actually physically beat you. Everything else is just what they call enhanced interrogation techniques. We were taught those in the Army in Ranger School. Yes, it's torture. It's different in a lot of state or local jails, but even there, the cops usually will slip nigger inmates a couple of packs of cigarettes to do the actual beating and the sodomizing. And needless to say, not one investigation has been opened into the FBI's own unlawful and despicable behavior during this Bill White case, nor will any of the agents who illegally arrested White, tortured him, tried to suborn perjury out of him, and violated his civil rights at every turn ever be disciplined or punished in any way. Now, that's not the way it works in Obama's America. Okay, now, let me finally wander in the general direction of the point. On Saturday, I published on my Thought Crime blog a brief and succinct article by Bill White describing what had been done to him in the prison system, and I was inundated in the comments section and also by private email with an incredible surge of bilious screaming hatred for Bill White to the effect of, how dare I defend this horrible, wicked man? And this came from people who had tangled with White basically back in the days when he was running Overthrow.com and so forth and so on. In other words, the usual movement, goat dancing goobu. I will have to say this for White. Other than myself, he attracts more of this nonsense, or at least he used to back in the day, than anybody else I've seen around in a long time. Okay, I will admit to start with that, yeah, personally speaking, Bill White was an asshole. I don't know if he still is an asshole. I suspect that 2.5 years in prison for doing absolutely nothing has probably matured his outlook on life, put it that way. I don't know. I don't know if he's even going to stick with the movement or not. He did publish that one piece, which I copied from American Free Press, but I get the impression that he's trying to, you know, pick up his life. He probably doesn't have much interest anymore in getting back with the movement, at least for the time being. But let me just get this out here. Let me explain to you my view on all this. As I mentioned in the article itself, back when he was out and about before his arrest, Bill White and I were not on one another's Christmas card list. I won't get into what happened or our little disputes, etc., etc., because in view of what happened to White later on, it's petty and it's not worth preserving. Whether we like this man or not, and I frankly don't on a personal basis, we have to understand that he is a genuine martyr for the racial cause. He was arrested and sent to prison and tortured and threatened and abused, and they made every effort to destroy his life because he was a white nationalist and because he was posting things on the internet that the government didn't like. That makes him one of us, no matter what we may think of his personality, of his writings, whatever. Now, White had some very common faults back in the old days. He was one of these guys who thought that a computer made him invincible. He was one of these guys who I don't think ever quite fully realized that the computer and the internet isn't real. He was one of these guys who gets behind a computer keyboard and all of a sudden he gets a visit from Mr. Hyde. I think we've all been there. I've been there myself a couple of times, and I'm not going to deny that every now and then, you know, White would pick at me and I would pick back at him and everyone would have an amusing time. Well, that was immature behavior on my part. It was immature behavior on White's part, but it is now over and it pales in comparison to what this man has suffered on behalf of us all. Whether we like it or not, Bill White is now a player and he is a man of respect among us because he spent 2.5 years enduring the worst that Zog could dish out. He bore up under it and he came out, so far as I can tell, unbroken. Now, the question is, will he remain unbroken? I've seen this happen quite often. Guys go into prison, they come out, they'll write one or two articles about how it was all a big mistake or they were framed or whatever. But then they quietly slip out of sight and disappear into private life. Now, that may be what White will do. I know he has a business to try and build back up. I know he has a wife and a child he hasn't seen for almost 3 years. And nobody can blame him, least of all me, if he decides he's just plain had enough. But he's paid his dues now. And regardless of what happened before, We need to at least take that into account. And if we're not exactly going to welcome him back with open arms, at least we need to refrain from dragging up a lot of silly internet crap, which pales in comparison to what this man suffered for all of us. So that is why I quote-unquote defend Bill White, not because of what he did prior to 2008. Some of that was pretty nonsensical. Well, let's face it, some of it was downright weird. I am defending him because he has now earned the right to a defense. Could you, all you people who are picking at him now and who are sending me these tirades about him, could you have stood up to what White stood up to? I like to think that I could, but I don't know. I haven't had to yet. So like I said, if anyone ever asks why I am defending the wicked, evil Bill White, it's because he's paid his dues and he's earned it. Anyway, first music break. This isn't exactly a song. It's one of David Allan Coe's earlier and more politically incorrect numbers back from the days before he became a mid-level country star. No doubt he was taken up the mountain by some Nashville nabob dressed like Colonel Sanders, and young Mr. Coe was made to understand which side of his bread was buttered if he wanted to keep on doing well in country music. Anyway, this number's called Damn Wish I Was a Nigger.
If I was a nigger, I could drive a Cadillac with class, my pocket stuffed with welfare checks, and I could sit on my big black ass. Now you take a nigger, he ain't nobody's fool, he doesn't buy any gasoline to drive his kids to school. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. Our government has gone crazy, I'd change things if I could. If I was only a nigger, I could afford to live in a white neighborhood. Oh, the things that I could do if I was black and hell-bent. I could send my kids to college, and it wouldn't cost me one damn cent. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. The wife and I were down on our luck. We were really getting uptight. They said at the welfare office, you ain't black, you're white. Oh, how I've tried to get a job, a diploma I have with pride. The post office man laughed and said, you're not dark enough to even qualify. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. I took a civil service exam and passed it without shame. A nigger took one next to me, and he couldn't even write his own name. The nigger, he got the job. Now he's government top brass. He couldn't qualify for a trash truck. I'm out on the street on my ass. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. If I was a Jesse Jackson, I'd be nobody's slob, wearing $500 suits. That nigger hasn't even got a job. If I was Jackson Brown, I could sit back and relax. And if elected president, could paint the White House black. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. If I was a jigaboo, I could find me my roots with an afro big as a watermelon and a pair of white disco boots. If I was only dark complected, I could stand tall in this life. I could eat high off the hog, just me and my white wife. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. Things are supposed to be segregated, but things are a little off key. I've never seen a white man head of the NAACP. It ain't that I don't like a nigger. If I've rubbed you wrong by chance, take a look at that mistletoe hanging on the seat of my pants. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. If I was a kinky top, I could be a Martin Luther King. I'd have me a vision on a mountaintop, my song the whole world would sing. I could have me a peace march on the streets of Memphis, Tennessee. I could tear up the whole damn city, and the police wouldn't dare stop me. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. A lot of things in life I know, but one thing I can't figure, why a nigger can call me a honky, and I can't call a nigger a nigger. If I was a jungle bunny, I could ring a golden bell. I could be a Muhammad Ali and be loved by Howard Cosell. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. If I was a U-bangy, 7 foot tall and lean, I could be a famous player on a Washington basketball team. If I was only chocolate brown, I could have me some turnip greens, a possum fat and watermelon, chitlins, and a pot of butter beans. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. The old Martin Luther King was buried in Washington with class, face down in his box, so the politicians could kiss his ass. I guess it's just politics, and he sure gets my goat, kiss assing with a nigger just to get his vote. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. If I was only a burrhead, I'd live high on a hill, selling cocaine and prostitutes and popping all kinds of pills. Now take the NAACP. They can march and raise all kinds of hell. Let the KKK start to move, and they'll all wind up in jail. Damn, I wish I was a nigger. I dreamed my life was over. I heard St. Peter say, today we're taking only niggers. You've got to go the other way. Then I heard the devil. He said, I heard what Peter had to say, but I'm sorry to tell you, son, today in hell is nigger day. Damn, don't you wish you were a nigger? I'm going back to the hills of Arkansas, where they don't have those knocked down, one-sided nigger peace marches, protesters, welfare check grabbers. I'm gonna plant me some turnip greens in a watermelon patch, raise me a hog and a big fat possum. I said, yes, I am, you mother.
I'd like to make some quick observations before we go on. I assume by now that most of you who follow the news on Drudge Report and a few other sources that actually bother to report the real news in this country are aware of the fact that right now one of the big nigger sports in America is what are called flash mobs, large gangs of 50 to 100 blacks who are suddenly brought together all in one place in order to rob and assault white people, or sometimes to invade and loot stores and a shopping mall, that kind of thing. This nigger fad or pastime started in Chicago and seems to be spreading all over the country to Peoria and Los Angeles and Southern California. These flash mobs are brought together using Facebook and Twitter, which are now accessible on cell phones. Niggers still don't seem to be very interested in computers per se, but boy, have they ever picked up on cell phones and cell phone video cams. Remember that fad we had a few months ago about black women going berserk in fast food restaurants and assaulting white patrons and getting recorded on video cam, which then got uploaded to YouTube, etc., etc.? The second observation I'd like to make is this. Remember the so-called Arab Spring this year, which resulted in big, huge mobs appearing in public squares all across the Arab world and demanding their American puppet dictators who have ruled them for the past 30 years pack up and leave? In two cases, Tunisia and Egypt, these mobs actually made the dictator flee or crumple and hand over power to the army. In other countries, like Libya, Yemen, and Syria, these insurrections have started civil wars which aren't resolved yet. Well, these insurrections were mostly the work of the underground Muslim Brotherhood, but once again, the organizers of these huge mobs used Facebook and Twitter in order to bring them together. Now, third, remember the 2008 election and that $500 million that mysteriously appeared in Barack Obama's political campaign fund? Now, we now know that the bulk of it came from George Soros, but how did that money actually end up in Obama's account? It came through PayPal and other online money transfer programs disguised in small amounts of $2,000 or less, or whatever the legal minimum is. The overwhelming majority of that money has never been truly accounted for, and most likely wasn't even reported. It was quite probably even more than the generally accepted figure of $500 million. And almost all of it came through the Internet. Ron Paul gathered almost $20 million through the Internet. Now, the point I'm making is this. The fault is not the Internet. American niggers, American politicians, and Arabs are proving that the Internet can, in fact, be used to produce very definite real-world results with real-life people. The fault is us. That's what I've been telling you for a long time.
The white racial nationalist movement has completely wasted the past 50 years. It therefore is now no longer possible for the Aryan race to recapture the North American continent in its entirety. The only remaining option to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children is for the remnant of the racially conscious population of North America to relocate to the Pacific Northwest and establish our own sovereign nation. What is at stake here is our survival as a race. There is no longer any alternative to the Northwest Migration Plan. If this is not done, then the Aryan race will perish from North America and most likely from the rest of the Earth as well, since there will be no safe and racially homogeneous haven in which our people may rest, regroup, and replenish our numbers. It is necessary to reduce the racial survival problem to manageable proportions, shrink it to dimensions wherein we can concentrate what few remaining resources we have into a smaller area with shorter and closer interior lines of communication. On such a reduced scale, Aryan racial nationalism will begin to gain some political, social, and economic leverage on a local basis sufficient to effect actual change. Once in the Pacific Northwest, the incoming white refugees must engage in a vigorous and dynamic program of political action, propaganda, and educational activity. Eventually, there must be direct action to remove as much of the territory of the Northwest as possible from the jurisdiction and control of the United States and subsequently create an independent Aryan Republic based on the principles of National Socialism. This republic will be restricted to persons of unmixed European, non-Semitic, Caucasian racial ancestry, and no non-white of any kind will be allowed to reside there under any circumstances. If this is not done, then the white race will become extinct in North America by the year 2100. The consequences of such an extinction for human civilization and for the planet upon which we live would be horrific beyond the power of the imagination to encompass. The achievement of racial survival for Aryan man must override all other considerations of personal welfare, personal agenda, physical safety, legality, or individual interest. We have a job to do. To that task assigned to us by history, we must devote the remainder of our lives.
It can't be repeated often enough. The Northwest Imperative is above all driven by one single and decisive factor, that being the complete lack of any other realistic alternative plan to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We've frittered away the past 50 years. The clock has run out, and there's nothing else for us to do. The Butler Plan consists of four broad aspects or phases. Now, these phases are not associated with any given time frame, so much as they entail a specific kind of activity and an agenda of goals to be achieved. All four phases or types of activity will be simultaneously ongoing, and at any given time, the movement will be involved with issues relating to any or all of these phases. There's going to be a lot of overlap, but basically it looks like this. Phase one has to be the relocation of the better elements of the existing racially conscious white community to the homeland. Now, this will be an ongoing project from this point on, and it'll continue even after political independence is achieved. It'll be the primary function of the homeland to be just that, a homeland and a refuge for all the persecuted and endangered Aryan peoples of the world, from Afrikaners to Serbs to Ulstermen. Racially conscious white immigrants into the homeland will hereafter be referred to as incomers to differentiate them from native-born Northwesterners and organic migrants. We propose to establish a Northwest agency very similar in scope and purpose to the Jewish agency that handled and still to this day handles the bulk of Jewish immigration to Israel. The Northwest Agency will not concern itself so much with political or propaganda issues, except in a very limited way to convince potential incomers of the necessity to come home. This agency will provide information, advice, and various kinds of practical assistance with regards to relocation.
Phase two will consist of massive, serious propaganda and missionary work among native Northwesterners and organic migrants. We must always bear in mind that by and large, precisely because they have grown up in a more or less all-white environment, the native-born genuinely do not understand what multiculturalism and diversity mean for them in the long run. They honestly do not understand what we are talking about, and we must conduct the most massive public relations and propaganda effort in this movement's history to convince them, using every tool we have from websites to participation in the local 4-H club. We must understand quite clearly that the white population of these three states are not enemies, they are our challenge. For the first few years, there will not be enough incoming settlers to make that much difference to the political situation or the demographic situation. We either win a sufficiently large percentage of those 8.5 million whites to our side to become viable and secure in our settlement program, or we will fail and our race will perish. 300 million people, almost half of them non-white, we will never win over. 8.5 million people sharing our blood, if not our views and our experience, there we've got a chance.
Phase three will be the creation of a political movement for Northwest independence. That's pretty much self-explanatory. The present unformed and nebulous Northwest front we got will do quite nicely for that purpose. In actual practice, beyond the creation of a few basic policy documents like the Constitution, so forth and so on, and a general consensus surrounding the idea of independence, this phase is pretty much going to have to go on the back burner for a while we concentrate on phases one and two. We can't allow a situation of too many chiefs and almost no Indians to develop, such has been the hallmark of a lot of movement work people have done down through the years. Now, a revolution cannot succeed in the absence of what I call the revolutionary tripod. That's three conditions without which true change can never take place. Now, let's review these three conditions again. I know I've done this a lot in the past, and some of you are probably tired of hearing of it, but it's one of those things that bears repeating. Number one, there must be a bona fide revolutionary movement devoted towards seizing state power directly from the hands of the existing power structure. Not conservative, not reformist, not willing to work within the existing system, but dedicated to its destruction. Number two, there must be withdrawal of the consent of the governed, wherein a majority of the people in a country or territory no longer wish to be ruled by the existing power structure, and they want change. Not just any change, but specifically, they want power to be assumed by that bona fide revolutionary movement I just mentioned. Number three, there has to be the loss of the credible monopoly of armed force by the state. Acts of insurrection and guerrilla warfare have to take place. Actual and serious physical damage must be inflicted on the enemy, and no one must be caught or punished for these acts. This condition is necessary not only to bring about the change itself, but to force the power structure into repression and acts of atrocity and retaliation against the general population in their frustration at being unable to locate and apprehend the real guerrillas.
Our long-term goal is to present the government of the United States with a situation whereby the struggle to retain the Northwest becomes politically and financially insupportable, and letting the homeland go is the lesser of two evils from their point of view. This is the way in which all colonial wars are won, and in order to win, we must reduce our racial struggle to the status of a colonial war wherein writing off X amount of territory is an option for the occupying power, should it become expedient. We must prepare for the time to come when all of this is more than just paper fantasy, when the political and economic realities make our victory a possibility if we are ready to seize it. It is going to take many years and a big assist from economic and political developments within the New World Order to create this tripod in the Pacific Northwest, but it will happen eventually.
Well, phase four is the creation of a sub rosa economic, social, and organizational infrastructure that is capable of assuming power and running a white society. Now, this will eventually transmute itself into direct action to free our homeland from the iron heel of the federal government. That's the part we can't talk about, of course, and it would be grossly premature in any case, even if it weren't dangerous. We have to learn to walk before we can run, and frankly, we have to learn to crawl before we can walk. One of the main things that we'll need to concentrate on during phase three is creating an economic infrastructure that will eventually enable us to employ our own people and free them from the now ever-present danger of establishment retaliation through loss of their jobs. Now, bear in mind that we are engaged in something that our ancestors understood, and they did superbly. We are nation-building. And there's a hell of a lot more to nation-building than singing around the campfire and throwing the odd bomb on the barricades. The main thing here is to utilize our human resources to the max. One of the things that our forebears understood, and indeed they had to understand to survive, was economic self-sufficiency. Remember all those gentleman adventurer types who first came to Jamestown and damn near starved to death because they wouldn't work and they hunted for gold instead of farming and hunting and building shelter? We have to be able to support ourselves in the face of pressure from the local Zog, which will be almost as intense in its own way as the pressure that the Indians put on the first settlers.
By economic self-sufficiency, we mean the actual production of wealth or essential goods and services. Economic self-sufficiency does not mean pyramid schemes or marginal business franchises or the assorted get-rich-quick deals which flourish in the right wing. It means the economic exercise of bona fide skills and resources to provide real goods and services. One of the major investments our new Northwest community will have to make is in vocational training for young white people. Every young white man and woman must possess a marketable skill so they can survive on their own. A new nation does not just need soldiers or political agitators. A new nation requires farmers, engineers, doctors, architects, electricians, road builders, and heavy equipment operators, construction trades, food processing and packaging skills, teachers, and manufacturers. We must bring to the Northwest serious adult men and women who are coming to build a new nation, not drink beer and scream white power and show off their tattoos. Young people, especially who are contemplating the homeland, must be encouraged to stay in school and learn an economically viable trade so that when they immigrate to the Northwest, they don't just say, "Hi, I'm a white racist." They must be able to walk into a community and say, "Hello, my name is so-and-so, and I am a computer software designer, or a skilled auto mechanic, or a master electrician, or a nurse, or I can fix your copy machine, or I can fly your helicopter, or I can bake bread." You get the idea.
The name of the country we propose to create is going to be the Northwest American Republic, or NAR. I've had people ask me about why isn't the Northwest Aryan Republic. Well, the racial term Aryan needs to be avoided because it causes confusion among the uninitiated, and winning over the uninitiated is how we're going to win. Now, for better or worse, Aryan is now associated in the minds of native-born Northwesterners with an image of tattooed, shaven-headed punks who swill beer and wave assault rifles in the air and scream white power. The fact that this is untrue, and that the native-born Northwesterners are Aryans themselves by race, if not in mind, is beside the point. In politics, perception is everything. It's bad propaganda to confront people on their initial contact with ideas, concepts, terms, and symbols that require an immediate, long, and abstruse explanation. Esoteric terms like Cascadia or Area, etc., should be avoided as well. They sound odd, and we're going to have trouble enough overcoming our image problem as things stand. Now, there's one thing that we do need to begin propagating here immediately, and that's the general recognition of our tricolor flag for the coming homeland. Now, this is the one point where I admit I made an arbitrary decision, and that's in the matter of the flag. I decided on a simple, dignified design which contains no controversial symbols or anything requiring more than the simplest explanation. Green for the land, blue for the sky above it, and white for the people who live in between. A general rule with Americans is never confront them with anything that you have to stop and explain. You do that, you've lost them.
The blue, white, and green flag of the new nation will be our rallying point. It must be displayed, distributed, and publicized the world over until it becomes the equivalent of the Confederate battle flag and the swastika flag as a generally recognized symbol of Aryan hope and courage in the face of racial death.
Second music break. I've already played Grandpa Jones's version of the old Western ballad, Jesse James, but he's not the only musician who was fascinated by the legend of the James Boys. This is Warren Zevon.
On the losing side, so no amnesty was granted. jet.
Okay, back to the subject we've been talking about on this program for the past several weeks, i.e. professionalizing the Northwest Front into a real party of white nationalist revolution. Now, those of you who are movement history aficionados and who've been around for a while will be aware of the fact that at certain times in our past, certain groups and organizations within our little subculture have, in fact, obtained a certain amount of what might loosely be called success. Depending, of course, on how you define success. The old UKA, the old John Birch Society, although, yes, I know they weren't really white nationalists, Rockwell's group in Arlington, the NSPA in Illinois and North Carolina, Bob Miles's Mountain Church, the White Patriot Party in North Carolina, Forsyth County, Georgia, the whole long Aryan Nations era in Idaho, so forth and so on. Now, rather than go into a long discussion over just what constitutes, quote-unquote, success, and why we're always ready to settle for so little of it, for the sake of brevity here, let's just define success as having a lot of people interested in your group, a lot of money coming in, a lot of literature being passed out, a lot of successful meetings and speech-making, maybe some fairly serious street activity, and above all, a lot of media publicity with a fearless leader figure appearing on television and maybe even in some cases becoming a minor celebrity before his 15 minutes are up and they pull the plug on him. Me, I had my own 15 minutes back during the Greensboro days, and I can tell you from personal experience that it is not an edifying experience. To this day, I hate and despise reporters of all kinds, almost as much as I despise lawyers. They're professional liars who make a living destroying other people's lives. Other people love it, though. Can't get enough of those camera lights. David Duke and a number of lesser figures thrive on it. Glenn Miller used to go rigid with excitement any time he got within 100 feet of a television camera. Now, some of these guys and gals, lest we forget, will do anything or say anything, make fools out of themselves in almost any way in order to prevent the TV crews from turning off those lights and packing away the cameras. Anyway, I've noticed something down through the years, and possibly so have some of you. If we accept what I just mentioned as the thumbnail definition of quote-unquote white nationalist success, and for the sake of argument, let's do accept that definition for the moment, It is a fact that the few periods of success our wee little movement has had in the past have all been built around one of two things, possibly both, a piece of land and or a formal organization of some kind, usually both, actually. I'm not talking about booksellers and publishers or skinhead rock groups, that kind of thing, and certainly not about my novels. Publishers and musicians and writers alone can succeed in making a marginal living off book and music CD sales. Or at least they could in the old days before the internet more or less replaced the printed page. I'm talking about guys like James Warner, Ed Fields, even James Mason. Now, they made it for years. Anyway, the fact is that to achieve actual success in the terms of number of people, property, publicity, one has to at least pretend to be an organization. And yes, land and formal organizations are two things that I myself have been arguing against for some time now for very valid reasons, which I've explained in the past and which I'll go over again here in a bit. But I say again, the simple and undeniable fact is that when these two factors are present, land and formal organization, we do seem to be able to produce a little bit of what might be loosely defined as success, at least in the form of media publicity, and apparently that's how American white nationalists define success. We don't define success as actually winning and seizing state power and defeating the Jews and removing the federal government and saving the white race from destruction, because none of us actually believe that's possible. But we are willing to accept seeing fearless leaders face on CNN as an adequate substitute, for a while anyway, until the character issue kicks in. Like I mentioned, I myself have been arguing against getting a so-called compound or an open headquarters building with the flags out, and after what happened in the John Hinckley case, I can tell you that I am damn sure never signing another membership card. But I'd like to invite all of you to play devil's advocate for a bit, and let's rethink this. Am I wrong? If land and formal organization does, in fact, create these trappings of what we define as success, such as more members and more money and more media publicity, if land and formal organization appears to accomplish the incredible feat of getting racially aware white people to get up from behind their computer screens and actually do something, then maybe I've called this wrong. And one of the reasons that the Northwest Front is moving forward so slowly is that I am simply a bad salesman and a bad businessman. Maybe the fault is mine because I'm not giving people what they want, which is one of the basics of good business. Now, me, I've never considered the Northwest Independent Movement to be a business. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe I should have. Let's go over all this, and by the way, I'm not being sarcastic here, and I'm not trying to lay any traps or make any rhetorical points here. I'm entirely serious. I keep telling you that we have to get this show on the road, and that means that somehow or other I have to find some way to get you to respond. We are running out of time here. And I'm becoming so desperate to find some way to get you people to respond that I am willing, if not to try anything, at least to consider anything. Okay, first off, let's go over how things were back in the day when we had all this alleged success, and then let's look at what's happened since then. I will use my own first group as an example, the old Franklin Road NSWPP, or American Nazi Party. First off, in those days, any group worth its salt had at least a couple of actual buildings. I think at one time, Cale's group had six of them around the country. Arlington, El Monte, Cicero, Baltimore, St. Louis, and Cleveland. Now remember, this was in the days before we were flooded with 30 million illegal immigrants who snapped up all the rental property in America and bought up whole city blocks of commercial property and drove rents and mortgages through the roof. I might mention, en passant, that this is one strong argument for getting rid of all these goddamned illegal aliens, so normal white families who have had their ticky-tacky McMansions foreclosed on can rent a house at an affordable price. An old-style urban headquarters building with the signs and the flags out isn't feasible anymore because, number one, you'd have to take out at least $500,000 mortgage even for a storefront, or you'd have to find some landlord with balls the size of grapefruit who would be willing to rent to you. Now, true, in Raleigh, Iran, too, rented buildings as open headquarters, but that was back in the 1970s and 80s when white people still owned some rental property and a few of them still had some moral courage. Today, almost all commercial rental property is owned either by non-whites, mostly Indians and Chinese, who smuggled their savings into this country in the form of diamonds and narcotics, and then bought certificates of deposit and real estate, so forth and so on, or else it's owned by faceless corporations as some tax write-off for the super rich, and their office managers aren't going to be favorably inclined towards white nationalists opening up a headquarters in their buildings. I won't say that doing things the old way is absolutely not feasible these days. I suppose it's always possible to find some old coot who inherited a building somewhere from his granddaddy and who is just ornery enough to rent to us, if only to spite the liberal neighbors. Now, that's how Commander Rockwell got hold of Hatemonger Hill in Arlington. The old codger who owned the building hated his neighbors and he wanted them to see a Nazi flag going up every morning. But it's unlikely. So, how about one of these famous rural so-called compounds that the movies and the TV cop dramas claim that we have so many of? Now, we shouldn't be doing that because we don't need to be hiding out in the woods. We need to be in the cities where the minorities and the problems are and where the action will be in the future. And we need to be making political capital off those minorities and those problems. But for the purpose of discussion, let's just decide that we want to go the bucolic compound route, because no one will ever take the Northwest Front seriously if we don't have a rural compound guarded by bearded fanatics wearing strange uniforms and carrying automatic weapons, right? A truth to tell, that actually might be a little more feasible. It's true, there's still some very cheap land available up here in the Northwest, but it is way, way, way out in the back of the beyond. I mean, the really cheap land is so far out in the boondocks that our supporters will have to be Daniel Boone to find the place. Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, the Idaho High Desert, the middle of mountain ranges, the depths of trackless forests, 20 miles from the nearest paved road and 50 miles from the nearest town with a gas station. Needless to say, there'll almost certainly be nothing already in place on such a cheap property. No electricity, no water and sewer, no paved road access, so that during the rain and the snow season, we'd be as isolated as the Donner Party and we'd probably end up eating each other. Yes, I know, this is what Pierce did, but he had that $300,000 that kind of dropped out of the sky from somewhere. Now, we have repeatedly tried this business of, if you build it, they will come. Well, time and again, we've built it, and the white people don't come. We have to find out why that is, and we need to change it. Now, getting back to my original question, people, is this what you want? A finished product. A Northwest Front bandwagon that you can jump on. After all, you are 21st century Americans, you're not 20th century Europeans, and you're not medieval monks. Americans will jump on a bandwagon in double quick time. It's just that pioneer gene that enables us to go first that we seem to have lost. So, is this the kind of bandwagon you're looking for? Let me know. Okay, once more, returning to back in the day. The old NSWPP system was actually pretty good if you're going to run a formal organization with all the paperwork. Now, the first thing a new person did was to fill out an official supporters application form, in which he or she agreed to send in $5 a month to the party. In exchange for that, he got the NS Bulletin, which was our internal newsletter, twice a month, in theory anyway. At any given time, the bulletin would be at least a couple of issues behind schedule. But the bulletin was a good morale builder because every issue there would be a few pictures of four or five of the guys wearing their little Matty Cale suits standing on street corners in various places around the country, handing out leaflets or holding signs, whatever. Now, these little activities never accomplished any real change, of course, and they never brought in much in the way of membership, but they looked good to isolated people who were getting their bulletins in the mail, living all alone in their communities, many of whom had never even so much as met another National Socialist or even another racially aware white person. It boosted morale by giving the impression that there was this big, huge organization somewhere out there fighting for white people, and of course it motivated the supporters as well to keep on sending in their dues and adding a couple extra bucks. And lest this sound too cynical on my part, I view things like that as entirely legitimate. Any actual political organization has to have money. There is no way around it. If you're going to engage in serious political work for real change, there's only two ways you can do it: with money or with a gun. And since we don't have the courage or discipline or the intelligence to use the gun, then that leaves money. And so long as the money collected isn't squandered and it's used for the racial purpose it was donated for, then I think most techniques for raising it are legit. The official supporter of the old NSWPP also got a little membership card with a swastika on it, which would sometimes cause all kinds of trouble when it got into the wrong hands, and I have a fund of stories about that, but we won't get into it because it's irrelevant. Under no circumstances whatsoever will the Northwest Front ever do any such thing. No membership cards. Not ever. No way, Jose. That's the name of that tune. With each issue of the NS Bulletin, the official supporter would also receive an activity report form, wherein he was supposed to report on how much party literature they distributed every month, the meetings and the publicity stunts the supporter had pulled, sent us clippings of any coverage, that sort of stuff, so forth and so on. The information on these reports would provide most of the contents for the next NS Bulletin. Now, after 6 months as an official supporter in good standing, the person was able to apply for probationary party membership, and 6 months after that, full membership, which supposedly brought you certain other privileges, although very few people actually made it that far for various reasons, which I won't get into. Now, this, of course, was during the 1960s and 1970s, when things were a lot different than they are today in many, many ways. I think the problems with this formal organizational approach should be pretty blatantly obvious in the year 2011. But even in those days, we could see it. When the headquarters was raided by the FBI, as it often was back in the early days, you would see pictures in the local newspaper of FBI agents hauling out huge file boxes of paper documents at the front door. Nowadays, of course, they just seize people's hard drive. Now, I'm not proposing any such system like this for the Northwest Front, because not only would it not work in this day and time, but it would be terribly dangerous if anybody tried it. Given the level of almost hysterical paranoia which pervades the legal and judicial system in this country now, any kind of formal racist organization at all is going to be overrun in about two shakes of a drake's tail with every kind of undercover cop and spook imaginable. We'd have these situations where there would be four guys going out to sell newspapers or picket something, and of the four, three would be undercover cops and one would be an undercover reporter. But I noticed at the time that this system we had did in fact provide certain advantages. It boosted people's morale to feel that they were part of something bigger. It encouraged their regular financial support of the party. And it was a big help in generating the kind of activism we did back then, because you got that monthly form that more or less demanded that you not just sit there and read your material, but that you get out and you do something and report back to the headquarters on it. In other words, the organization, the party, made demands on people. It wasn't just a case of, well, get your newsletter and that's it. It wasn't just a case of send in your $5, get your publications, and that's all we particularly care to be involved with you. And that's one of the marks of a genuine revolutionary organization or a party. It makes demands on its own people. I did this for a while in my own NSWPP Mark II back in the 1990s. And I noticed that those activity report forms most certainly did have an effect on activism. Now, this, of course, assumes that the guys were telling the truth on the activity report forms that they turned in, and they weren't just yanking my chain, but we won't get into that. Now, the question that I would like for you listeners to ponder and get back to me on is this. How can we in the Northwest Front achieve the psychological and activity advantages of that system without all the risks which it would be insane to take in today's political and racial atmosphere as far as records keeping and signing things goes? How can we give our people that sense of belonging that we had back in the old days without their actually belonging to anything or signing anything that could later be used against them in court to establish guilt by association? How can we get a bandwagon rolling that people can jump onto without actually having a vehicle? I'll think about that, and I'll discuss some of the better and more serious replies next week. Third music break. We haven't had a good old-fashioned Irish rebel song on here for a while, and I don't remember where I got this one. It was off the internet someplace, and I don't seem to have made a note at the time of the group that sings it, for which I apologize, but this is the Boys of Kilmichael.
While we are honor in song and in story, the memory of Pearson McBride, whose names are loomed in glory by martyrs who long held since died. Forget not the boys of Kilmichael, who feared not the might of the foe. The day that they marched into battle, they laid all the blackened towns low. So here's to the boys of Kilmichael, those brave lads so gallant and true. They fought me the green flag of Erin and conquered the red, white and blue. On the 28th day of November, the towns left the town of Macroom. They were seated in two costly tenders that was bringing them straight to their doom. They were all on the road to Kilmichael and never expecting to stop. They there met the boys from the column who made a clean sweep of the lot. So here's to the boys of Kilmichael, those brave lads so gallant and true. They fought neath the green flag of Erin and conquered the red, white and blue. The sun in the west, it was sinking, 'twas the eve of a cold winter's day, when the towns we were eagerly waiting sailed into the spot where we lay. And over the hill came the echo, the peal of the rifle and gun, and the flames from the lorries brought tidings that the boys of Kilmichael had won. So here's to the boys of Kilmichael, those brave lads who kept and true. They fought me the green flag of Erin and conquered the red, white and blue.
One quick comment here. Remember that new guy Marcus and I were telling you about? Well, he started work this week. If memory serves, he got here about a month ago, so basically it took him 2 weeks to get a job, then 2 weeks of hunting for a place to live so he could be near where he works. Basically, a guy rolled up into one of our yards with nothing but what was in his car. And 1 month later, he's employed and housed. That's what all you nervous Nellies are afraid of. That's the horror that awaits you here. It can be done, people. In the middle of last week, a news article appeared in the media. It was a kind of article that's become more and more common over the past few years. Indeed, so common that when Matt Drudge linked to it, he didn't even bother to link it in red. The article was to the effect that in the year 2010, less than half of the babies born in the United States were white. 48%, I think it was. We are a people facing extinction, and Matt Drudge doesn't even consider that to be worth a red link. It's old news. The same day that I came across this article, I received an email from a woman who had just discovered the NorthwestFront.org website and Radio Free Northwest some months before. She was and is absolutely enthralled. She's ordered and read my books. She ordered an info packet and a white book, and she tells me that she even started ordering touristy-type stuff and doing internet research on living conditions and so forth here in Washington and also in Oregon. Her enthusiasm may not last, but honestly, I think this lady's one of the out-of-state license plates we will eventually see coming over the hill here. Then, last week, while she was prowling the internet looking for more information about anything and everything she could find with regard to race in the Northwest, She came across a thread on one of the V bulletin boards, which consisted of nothing but personal abuse and vilification aimed at me personally and against the Northwest idea. Now, I won't name the board or the moron making the posts, although I am sure some of you can guess, except to say that it was one of these individuals whose brain seems stuck somewhere around the year 1998 and who appears to have developed an obsession bordering on insanity with me and with some very silly things that happened around that time period and some even sillier things that, in point of fact, did not happen. This is a very serious problem we have. In this day and age, when someone wants information about something, the first place they go is to the Internet. Unfortunately, the Internet does not come equipped with a fact checker or a gatekeeper, and the result is that a lot of the information one finds there simply isn't true. Now, this lady was intelligent enough to see that this person's argument, if you want to call it that, consisted of nothing except personal hatred of me and name-calling against anybody who believed in the Northwest Imperative, and that he did not offer one sliver of any kind of alternative plan to actually confront the crisis of our race and civilization and to secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. She didn't need much reassuring, but she was puzzled and confused, which, of course, was the reason for this person and this particular Lord of V-Bulletin posting the thread in the first place. Now, let's think about this. On the one hand, on the same day, we have a clear and public statement that our race is perishing from the face of the earth, that less than half of the infants now born in America are white. On the other hand, we have a creep who responds to this existential crisis by launching personal tirades of abuse against one single man and who is attempting to rewrite a piece of 13-year-old history that nobody gives a damn about anyway. What is wrong with this picture? People, we have got to stop acting like this. We have got to grow up. We can no longer allow the direction of what little we have by way of a racial resistance movement to be directed by a bunch of middle-aged adolescents who behave as if they were still in junior high school and who use the Internet, which, like it or not, is the only medium of mass communication open to us, as a play toy. I've asked you some questions in this episode and previous episodes of Radio Free Northwest, and I need answers. What exactly is it that you want from me in order to begin acting on what I say and no longer treating this podcast and this movement as a form of entertainment? Now, some of the discussion topics I propose this week seem odd. Just remember what motivated them. Somehow, I have to find the words. I have to find the magic beans that many of you seem convinced I have in my pocket. Well, I checked and they're not there. Somehow, I have to find the magic wand that so many of you are so sure I have hidden someplace so I can wave it and bring forth a finished product, a bandwagon for you to jump on. Somehow, I have to find the fast forward button on the tape, because too many of you are getting bored with the movie and will probably wander away if I don't cut to the car chases and the explosions soon. But the problem is, this isn't a movie. In the year 2011, we are having to build, brick by brick and pipe by pipe and screw by screw, the infrastructure that should have been built 50 years ago and should be already in place right now. Now, the fact that we are having to do this, the fact that our previous self-appointed leaders failed us, is shocking and tragic. But nonetheless, it's the reality we have to deal with. Now it's time to stop complaining and do it. It's time to pack that moving van and come home to where you are needed, to where you are supposed to be. It's time to get a small unit going in your part of the Northwest homeland and begin the process of freeing our people from third world tyranny and historical oblivion. Now, I am right now operating at pretty much the limit of what one man can do. I will continue to do so, but it just isn't enough. It's time for you to step forward and get involved in this struggle. Your home is here. Your future is here. Your duty is here. Why aren't you? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha on the bond. Freedom.
Follow in their footsteps of the rising moon.